Penguin Random House Audio presents Watch Me Disappear by Janelle Brown. Read for you by Tavia Gilbert with Kaleo Griffith. Prologue. It's a good day, or maybe even a great one, although it will be impossible to know for sure later. By that point, they'll already have burnished their memories of this afternoon, polished them to a jewel-like gleam. One of the last days they spent together as a family before Billy died. Of course Jonathan and Olive are going to feel sentimental about it. Of course they will see only what they want to see. Still, Jonathan will think, on the spectrum of all their days together, ranging from that time the whole family got food poisoning at Spenger's fish grotto to the day Olive was born, this one certainly ranks closer to the top. It is, for one thing, a clear, sunny day, which is no small piece of luck when you're on a Northern California beach in October. The sand is actually warm between their toes, instead of dank and gritty. But the air also has the crisp autumnal bite that makes you want to wrap yourself in something soft. No one acts crabby or restless or bored. Billy has packed some particularly delicious sandwiches, pesto chicken for the adults, hummus for Olive, who has recently gone vegetarian, and they wash these down with tepid cocoa from a thermos. After they eat their lunch, Billy and Jonathan sit on the beach while Olive goes down to the water's edge and mucks about barefoot in the surf. There's a tree-sized piece of driftwood that's been deposited near the crest of the tide line, and Jonathan sits with his back braced against this. He's brought printouts of a half-dozen decode features that urgently require his attention, but the whole point of the day was family time, to compensate for all those days and nights vacuumed up by his job. Besides, how can he focus on narrative coherence and Oxford commas when the tide is low and the surf is high? Billy uses Jonathan's bent legs as her chair, her long hair draping down his thighs. She studies the surfers bobbing out at the break as she scoops up sand and lets it trickle through splayed fingers, absently picking out rocks and twigs. Jonathan reaches out and takes a strand of her hair, one of the silver threads that are starting to lace through the dark brown. He rubs it gently between his fingertips, testing its texture, testing the temperature of his wife. "What are you, a monkey?" Billy says. She's built a tower of smooth stones, and she examines it, then flattens it again. "Still hungry, looking for snacks," he says. He looks up to see Olive at the edge of the water, studying them from a distance. He waves at his daughter, and she arcs her own arm back in a half moon of acknowledgement. She looks happy, but sometimes it's hard to tell. Her downturning mouth frowns even as it smiles, contradicting itself. A wave washes up the sand, licking at her bare toes, and she dances away from it. Billy follows his gaze. How is she going to manage? He releases her hair.
What do you mean?
In life. The world is tough on soft things. She's going to need to grow a thicker skin, or she's going to spend her whole life being too afraid to try anything. Jonathan studies his daughter, silhouetted by the crashing sea. She's spied something beneath her feet, a shell or a hermit crab or a piece of trash, and her brow furrows as she leans down and picks it up to examine it. He feels a flash of empathy for her, the bookish child he used to be in silent communion with the child she is. She's just sensitive. That's normal for 15. I was bold at that age, Billy says crisply.
You were not the typical kid, Jonathan says.
Billy laughs at this and tips her head backward over Jonathan's knees to smile at him. There's sand speckling her cheekbones, stuck in the delicate lines around her eyes, and he gently wipes it away.
Anyway, Olive is tougher than you're giving her credit for.
She lifts her head and examines their daughter in the distance.
Okay.
good. If you're so worried, talk to her, he adds. I tried when I took her hiking last month. Didn't go well. She sits upright and leans forward and away from him, running a hand through the tangle of her hair. She used to soak up every word I uttered like it was gospel. She doesn't do that anymore. Jonathan notes the edge of pained querulousness in her voice. Oh, please. She still worships you, he says. She's just a teenager. She's individuating. Keep trying. She'll come around soon. And it's good for her to know you care. As Jonathan watches Billy, he thinks that the person it really would be good for is his wife, who perhaps needs to feel needed by their daughter again. You don't realize how much you'll miss the asphyxiating intimacy of early parenthood until you can finally breathe again. Always the optimist, my Jonathan. She says this as she's looking out to sea, her words swallowed up by the pounding surf, so that for a moment he's not sure he's heard her right. He blinks, a flush of gratitude. Billy, I still think... But she cuts him off, her words cooling quickly. I can tell by your tone of voice where you're going, and don't, just don't. I don't want to talk about it. Down at the other end of the beach, the group of surfers has emerged from the sea, and they strip their wetsuits back like banana peels, bare flesh emerging from black neoprene. The boys jostle up against the girls, crowding their space, grabbing at their towels while the girls pretend to be indignant. Billy carefully wipes the sand from her hands as she stares at the surfers, the muscles in her back going taut under the thin cotton of her t-shirt. Jonathan wonders if she's seeing a former version of herself in the girls, in their loose-limbed freedom, in the way they demand that the entire beach notice them. He remembers that Billy, the girl he fell in love with 16 years earlier, and honestly, not so much changed. And he reaches out to massage the tenseness away, but she shrugs him off. They sit there like that for a while, silently watching the surfers collect their towels and then disappear in the opposite direction. Once they're out of sight, Billy's shoulders go slack. She stretches, lets out a muffled sound that's a cross between a sigh and a groan. You know, I might do a backpacking trip one of these weekends soon. Maybe up the Pacific Crest Trail. Again? With Rita? No, by myself. She gives a little laugh. You know, just me alone with my thoughts. Sounds nice. But is that such a good idea? He says, hiding a small hiccup of anxiety. Alone with what thoughts? Billy ignores this and stands up, crumpling the waxed paper from her sandwich with efficient finality. She beckons to Olive, who walks toward her mother with her hands full of some algae-covered flotsam that she's plucked from the sea. If we're going to see those butterflies before it gets too late, we should head up, Billy announces. She turns and jogs up the dunes without checking to see if her husband and child are following her. The Monarch Preserve is crowded, but not with butterflies. The arrival of the annual migration was announced in the local news earlier that week, and apparently Billy wasn't the only one to flag the story, because the tourists are out in force. Olive trails after her parents as they wander up and down the wooden walkways, craning her neck to scan the trees. The occasional butterfly flutters by overhead, an orange fleck backlit by the sun. The place is loud with the squeals of kids and shouting parents, unlike the reverent, hushed, templed nature that Olive had imagined. She dodges a woman now, followed by another, all of them busily Instagramming any old insect that flits by, as their children lunge at the butterflies with sticky hands. Alarmed, Olive wants to shout, "Don't they know that if they touch the butterfly's wings, they'll die? Did no one teach them to leave no trace?" She looks around at the overflowing trash cans, the parents wielding aerosol sunscreens, and worries that this is why there aren't more butterflies here today.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?